There's a story in Genesis that's intrigued me for years. In fact, a lot of stories are kind of fun. You go through those, and as a kid, when the minister was just really boring, I would, in the Protestant church the family went, I just pulled out a Bible and I would read the stories. And there was a story that was always particularly odd, and I've wondered about it over the years. And so perhaps you've wondered about it too. Today's title is Rachel's Bold Claim to Inheritance. Rachel's Bold Claim to Inheritance. Now, there's a story of Jacob, one of our forefathers or ancestors, and his wife Rachel. And if we take a look in Genesis 31 and verse 19, here's a verse that people most commonly remember and that gets them, that causes them to wander away in their thinking. In Genesis 31 and verse 19. And Laban, that would be Rachel's father, and we'll get into the relationship here in a minute. And Laban went to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the images that were her father's. Genesis 31, 19. And later in Genesis 31, verse 30, and now, though you would need be gone, because you longed after your father's house, yet wherefore have you stolen my God? So you have this stolen the images that were her father's, and then they're referred to as small g gods. So some questions come to mind here. Was Rachel a thief? Did she violate the commandment against stealing when she removed images from her father? Was Rachel hanging on to pagan practices of worshiping statues as gods? And why was Laban so upset at these missing images or gods? And on the surface, the obvious answer is, yeah. Rachel clearly says that she stole the images or gods and that Laban felt violated when the gods that he worshipped were removed. I mean, that's an obvious and easy conclusion. Well, we're going to dig into it a little deeper. We're going to look at some of the words and the definitions that were used and in the context to get a better understanding of what actually happened. I'm sure many of us may be somewhat familiar with the story of how Jacob came to be living in Syria with his uncle Laban. And for that story, we go to Genesis 28. And here we have, now, to put it in context, if we look at whose generation, there was Abraham, and Abraham had a son named Isaac, and Isaac had a son, had twin sons, Jacob and Esau, twins. And so in Genesis 28, verse 1, Isaac called Jacob, his son, and blessed him and charged him and said, "You shall not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. Don't marry one of the local girls. What should you do?" He said, "Go arise," verse 2, "go arise, go to Padan-Aram, go to the house of Bethuel, my mother's father, and take a wife from the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother." Well, Jacob's mother was Rebekah, who came from that area. And so Isaac said, "Go back and marry somebody on your mother's side of the family." And of course, nowadays, we don't do that too much. You don't go to family reunions to pick up a bride. Well, except for my grandmother came around. She was born in Gravette. Her parents were first cousins. Their fathers were brothers, many years apart and different last names. But that happened. But apparently it shouldn't happen too often. Now, it does happen in some cultures. I know in Islam, 60% of the people are born to first cousins. And this has been happening now for since the year 700 AD. So let's do the math. We're looking at over, 1,300 years of first cousin marriage. And so that can bring about problems. Indeed, one of my daughters and son-in-law worked at the project in Jordan for those who were mentally handicapped because it's a generational issue. And my daughter said, the school supervisor where they taught said, proudly announced his parents were not related. So while this looks uncomfortable on the surface of it, at that time it was closer to creation. and there wasn't the gene pool was a little different than what it is now. So what did Isaac say? He said, go to and get a wife from the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. Verse 3, and God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you that you may be a multitude of people. So the father is blessing the son and says, go there. Don't take a local wife. Let's move on. And interestingly enough, verse 4, and give the blessing of Abraham to you and your seed with you, that you may inherit the land wherein you were a stranger, which God gave to Abraham. Well, God granted a large area to Abraham. So verse 5, and Isaac sent away Jacob, and he, meaning Jacob, went to Paddan Aram to Laban, the son of Bethuel the Syrian, the brother of Rebekah, Jacob's and Esau's mother. So there we have it. Isaac had twin sons. The one of them married local gals, and Esau, and Jacob was sent away to go back to Rebekah's family, to Uncle Laban. And on the way, there was an interesting activity. In Genesis 28, and verse 12, we're right there. Jacob dreamed about this ladder coming, being set up on earth, and it reached to the top of heaven. It had to be quite a dream. Now, I've had wild dreams. I don't know that any of them have ever approached like this, but I've had from time to time. Depends on what I ate, if I ate supper or not, and what it was. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending. Verse 13, and behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham your father and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, to you I will give it and to your seed. So Jacob knew there was a promise, and this promise was coming not just from, you know, just not from word of mouth, okay, but he was hearing us in this vision. And verse 15, or in verse 14, and in your seed shall be as the dust of the earth. How many particles of dust are there? Uncountable, right? There's a lot. It's going to be a lot of offspring. And you shall spread abroad to the west, to the east, to the north, to the south. And in you and in your seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. We've often referred to that as the Abrahamic blessing. And verse 15, and behold, I'm with you and will keep you in all places where you go, and I will bring you again to this land. So Jacob knew he was going to be coming back. I will not leave you. I will not until I have done that which I have spoken to you of. So Jacob had that understanding of a promise given to Abraham. And this had an effect on Jacob, and he commemorated the occasion by setting up a stone pillar, a marker for what had occurred. Now, you think, well, that's not going to really mean anything. Well, we are looking at our culture now. We see a stone, we don't think so much of it. But historically, stones are how you mark the boundaries of territories. I know that when I grew up, my great-grandfather homesteaded, and there were stones. That was fertile, rich Black Prairie soil in central Minnesota. But every once in a while, you'd have big rocks, big stones, and he would haul them off with a horse and some planks nailed together in the ground. They called it a stone boat. You'd roll the stone on this stone boat. Horse would pull it off. You'd go to the corner of the field, and the neighbor would do the same, and there would be rock pile. That's the corner. That's a boundary. By the time my grandfather came along, the rocks that were picked up on the farm weren't quite as big. Great-grandfather, I was told, used dynamite to blast them into smaller ones. Not that there were a lot of them, but you hate to go around them with machinery. So by the time my grandfather was there, he said, well, he could put his arms around them. By the time my dad was there, he said, or closer, you know, the basketball ones were the problem. By the time I come along, we're closer to a softball and a football. Once in a while, you get a big one. And each, you say, well, why don't you pick them all up? Well, the moisture pushes the stones up under the ground. The moisture goes to the bottom of the stone, it freezes. Ice expands, causes the stone to rise. So over the course of years, they keep popping up. And so by the time my kids, when I take them out to the farm for the enjoyment of rock picking, I call them geology lessons, the stones would be much smaller, size of a baseball or an egg. So And they were always put on the corners or the edges of the field as a marker, because you weren't going to use the corner or the edges anyway. This is still done. If we look out west, there are corner posts. They will take woven wire, put it in a loop, fill it full of stones, because the ground is too rocky to put a post in the ground, and then you'll have these pillars made of a pile up stones. And then when I was a kid, I remember, I don't know how I got it, but I got a Boy Scout manual. Now, we were never Boy Scouts. Dad said, you learn more than that being on the farm. And we believed him, but I had this manual, how to tie knots, and then how to leave a message. So you'd have a stone. I was to camping, if you're on a trail, you'd put a bigger stone, and then you'd put one or two smaller stones in the direction that you want, that you were going or wanted to direct somebody to. So I can see that this has been done thousands of years. And so here we have a stone marker Jacob set up that says to commemorate this promise, that that ground was promised to him and his forefathers and his offspring forever. And Genesis 28, we read the vow that Jacob had about the deal with God. And in verse 22, and this stone which I've set for a pillar shall be God's house. And he then says, I will surely give a tenth to you. So he already understood tithing at that time. So this pile of stones was an evidence of an understanding and agreement. And we're going to come back to this later in the story. So now we go about, Jacob continues on in this trip about how he met and married Rachel. And we go into Genesis 29, and it talks about he shows up in the area. Now, I don't know, he didn't have a Rand McNally map, he didn't have GPS, but somehow he found his way. I presume his mother and father, well, his mother was the one that came from there. She'd be the only one to give him directions. His father had never been there. Isaac hadn't been there. Or his father's servants who were there. And it says, Genesis 29:1, Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the people of the east. And he beheld a well, and there were flocks of sheep. And we read on, and there was a well there. Now, the wells were subject to being filled with blowing dirt. So if you have a well, you want to cover the well so it doesn't, over time, get filled with dirt. And so what did they do? They would put a round stone on it and then roll it off when they wanted to draw the water. When you're done, you roll the stone back onto it. And so he came to a well in verse 4, and he said, where do you come from? And they said, Haran. And he said, do you know of Laban, the son of Nahor? This is who he's looking for, his mother's brother. And I said, yeah, we know him. And we read on. And he said, well, why aren't you watering your shop? And he says, well, we have to do it all together. We're going to roll the stone away once, and then we'll roll it together. And then while they're there, here comes this girl shepherding her father's sheep in verse 9, happened to be named Rachel. And she was the daughter of the very man he was asking for. And so Jacob went and he helped roll. So it's presumably it's a big old stone. Takes more than one person to roll it off. And verse 11, it says, now in King James, it says, and Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept. Now, that's King James language, but bear in mind, it's the same word they use for greeting. So let's not be thinking that he laid a sloppy one on her. I wasn't there. We don't have a video of it, but it's the word used for greeting. And then he went and explained, verse 12, Jacob told Rachel he was her father's brother. He was Rebekah's son. And what did she do in the last half of verse 12? She ran and told her father. She didn't say, oh, ho-hum, well, that's interesting. See you around sometime. She ran and told her father, because visitors were pretty important, pretty big news. So we read on about Laban hurting. Now, bear in mind that Laban's sister, Rebekah, and this is a previous message, if you haven't heard it, about Rebekah's marriage, was sent away to marry this Isaac, and now the son comes back. And so if we look at that, the presence that Isaac's servant brought along for the bride price for Rebekah was significant. They knew that Isaac's family was well-to-do. And so now there's a return. There's the next generation coming by. It's pretty big news. And so verse 13, when Laban heard the tidings of Jacob's sister, his sister's son, he ran to meet him, embraced him, and kissed him. And there again, I suspect it was not a sloppy lip kiss, but a greeting, and brought him to his house, and he told Laban all these things. And then verse 14, Jacob stayed there for about a month. And from the next verse, we find that Laban says, you know, you're my brother. Now, brother doesn't mean literal brother. It means you're related. You've come to my household. We have this close relationship, just like we're brethren, only there, in fact, it was his mother's brother. So it's a general term of relationship. Should you serve me for nothing? In other words, clearly Jacob has been working for that month. He wasn't sitting there watching cable TV and playing video games. So he was making himself useful. And Laban says, what should I, what kind of wages would you want? In other words, it was seemed obvious that he was providing value. Jacob was providing value. And give a young man a choice, he might actually verbalize that choice. And Jacob did. And what did Jacob say in verse 18? Jacob loved Rachel and said, I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. Well, then Laban says, well, okay, I suppose. I guess you're as good a choice as any. Back of his mind, I'm sure he knew that Jacob's mother was sent off with a wealthy man, and there might be something coming down the road. It's better that that kind of a person take care of his daughter. He already knew the work ethic was there. So now we have this bargain to work 7 years for Rachel. And verse 20, this is interesting. Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed unto him but a few days for the love he had to her. Now, I'm just, I can speculate as long as the next one. Why 7 years? Well, 7 years has several possibilities. And one of those is when people populated America as early colonists, it was expensive to buy a ticket on a ship. And to buy a ticket on a ship, they would sell 7 years of labor as an indentured servitude. I will give you a contract. And this contract says, I will serve my employer for 7 years. At the end of 7 years, then you will pay me, you will provide my room and board. I will work for you if you pay my passage on the ship. At the end of this time, then I get a set of clothes, a set of carpentry tools, whatever it takes to set up make my own homestead, my own way. And now I'm in the new land. And this is many indentured servants came to America this way. This was not a new concept. And so what does Jacob say? He says, I'll serve 7 years. But I have another theory, completely unsubstantiated. Maybe Rachel wasn't quite old enough to be married. I don't know. We don't know this. We aren't given all the data in this story. And so he said that it went quickly. Now, if something isn't going well, do you say that it's going quickly and you hardly knew the time flew by? Or does it feel like it drags on forever? You've been in a classroom and you've watched the clock on the wall, tick, 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 and you think, this is the longest minute I've ever had, and there's 57 more to go. You know, just, oh, it's so long. Or will that speaker ever finish and sit down? How long is this going to be? You know, the slow time. But he, boom. So clearly, his infatuation lasted for more than the 7 years. And we come into the awkward situation. There was a huge feast, a wedding feast at the end of 7 years. A wedding feast was done to acknowledge publicly of a wedding in that time. Nowadays, what do people do? They can go down to the courthouse, fill out a document, pay their $60, and get the official notarized seal on it for the marriage license, and they can get married right there and have it signed off by a clerk of court or a judge, or you can have a clergyman do it and then file the form, and it's all done officially. I've done weddings in 3 states and in Europe, and it's each jurisdiction's a little different. They all have their different rules, but basically it's you got to have the right pieces of paper. We don't read anything about the right pieces of paper here. What we're reading in this scenario is that there's a wedding feast, that it publicly acknowledges that there's a wedding. And that's the way it's been done, frankly, for thousands of years, that people get together, the family does. And there's a lot of work involved in that feast. They're going to have to do the slaughtering of the livestock to roast the cattle or the sheep or the goats or whatever they're doing. It's a big to-do. I remember my grandmother preparing for my parents' surprise 20th anniversary. She was a busy lady, organizing all the things, her 5 brothers, getting them all to do stuff to prepare for it. And my parents were completely surprised by this. Later on, with my grandparents' 40th and 50th, there was a lot to do, these celebrations. And I can see how this would similarly be the case there. So you have this big celebration going on. And surprise, surprise, of course, in that culture, apparently the brides were veiled. And it was the next morning when Jacob found out that he had the wrong bride, which had to be a huge disappointment. And we don't read in here that Rachel's sister Leah said anything or complained. Figured he must have been a good catch, and we'll just leave it at that. And so we read on how to solve the problem. Well, Laban was a very tricky fellow. He knew how to make a bargain, and so he did. And so he said, and as we read on, we find that Laban said, well, I'm not going to have the older one marry before the younger one. So that's just the way we do things here. Sorry if you didn't realize that. Didn't even say sorry, I don't think. But you can do the honeymoon week with this one, and you can have the other sister if you work for me another 7 years. Well, he's got 7 years worth of labor. He's already recognized that God is blessing him for the sake of Jacob being there. So that was the reluctant bargain that was struck, and now Jacob has sisters who are wives. In college, we had a rule. You never date sisters and you never date roommates because it's not going to work out well. Just, I think everybody almost automatically understands that that's a bad situation. However, and then after those 7 years were up, Jacob had done his, had fulfilled his end of the bargain. And what does then, what does Jacob say? And Jacob says, and by now he's having children, and we're looking in, let's look in Genesis 30. And after, in Genesis 30, verse 25, when Rachel had borne Joseph, Jacob said to Laban, now the 14 years are up, send me away that I may go to my own place and my own country, give my wives and my children for whom I have served, and let me go, for you know my service, which I have done for you. Well, his time is up. I'm ready to go. He knows that God has promised him. So what does he say? Laban say in verse 27? I'll boil it down. Please stay. But why? Laban said to him, I pray you, if I found favor in your eyes, tarry or stay, for I've learned by experience that the Lord has blessed me for your sake. So Laban is acknowledging God. Clearly acknowledging. He knows that there's a blessing that flows forth from it. So we don't have evidence here that Laban's disavowing or disregarding the existence and the presence of God. So verse 28, what does Laban go on to say? Appoint me your wages and I will give it. In other words, tell me what you want. What do you want? You know, I like your work and I like the blessings that come forth. And And he goes on to explain, you know, that he's been well blessed. His livestock have increased dramatically. So what does Jacob say in verse 31? And he goes through and he says, you know what? We'll separate out the livestock and I'll take a certain kind. And you can have the other ones. We'll just remove different colors of cattle and so forth, and sheep and goats. And then I will take, and that way it'll be clear to tell whose belongs to what, which makes sense. And so Laban said in verse 34, behold, it would be according to your word. In other words, yeah, we'll do that. We'll strike the bargain. Sounded good to him. And then verse 36, he set 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob. And Jacob fed the rest of Laban's flocks. Then it goes on, and what happened was, is in verse 43, the man, meaning Jacob, increased exceedingly and had much cattle and maidservants, men servants, camels, and asses. The livestock that Jacob had reproduced more readily than the ones that Laban had. So, and then we have a problem comes up. And here's a problem, and it's at the crux of this entire story about Rachel. Because whatever conditions then that Laban put on Jacob regarding Jacob's wages, God was always with Jacob, and he blessed Jacob. But time and time again, Laban changed the terms of Jacob's employment. And now we come to Genesis 31 and verse 1. And this is the first time we hear a mention of Laban's sons. Now, it's my own speculation that Leah and Rachel were born before any sons were born to Laban. Because otherwise, who would have been tending the sheep? Rachel was out tending sheep. And now we hear a mention of the son. So in that 20 years, it appears that Laban has sons. And what are they saying? And he heard the words of Laban's sons, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and of that which was our father's, he has gotten all this glory. In other words, he got rich off dad, you know. Well, and that would have been our inheritance. They were getting very possessory about that. Verse 2, and Jacob beheld the countenance of Laban, and behold, it was not toward him as before. So when Laban's sons were complaining that your son-in-law is making off with the estate, he's getting away with everything, and you're letting him do it. And what did Jacob perceive? There wasn't warm feelings anymore between himself and his father-in-law, because Jacob had overheard his young brothers-in-law talking about usurping the inheritance from their father Laban. Jacob had now been working for Laban for 20 years. And Jacob again asks his father-in-law, Laban, that he, Jacob, be allowed to return back to his father, Isaac, along with his wives and children. We read that in Genesis 30 and verse 25 and 26 about, wanting to go back, and yet he stayed another 6 years. And so, and we know that Laban knows he was blessed by God through Jacob. And if we turn to Genesis 31, it's time for a family meeting. Jacob has a family meeting, and he calls Leah and Rachel. And he calls them into the field. If we were Genesis 31, we read in verse 3, and the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I will be with you. Verse 4, and Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to the field to his flock. Not at home, not in the tents. Nobody could hear. They're way out where the flocks are. Nobody's going to hear. We have this little family conference. And what does he say? Jacob says, verse 5, I said to them, I see your father's countenance, that it is not toward me as before. But the God of my father has been with me. You know that with all my power I have served your father Laban. Verse 7, and your father has deceived me and changed my wages 10 times, but God suffered him not to hurt me. So every time Laban thought to take advantage of it, Jacob wound up being blessed. Verse 8, if he said, the speckled shall be your wages, then the cattle were, that were born were speckled. If he said, the ringstrake shall be your higher than all the then the cattle all bear ringstraked, or that color cattle. Verse 9, thus God has taken away the cattle of your father and given them to me. And it came to pass at the time the cattle conceived, I looked up in my eyes and saw in a dream. And he talked about, well, the rams that serviced the sheep were all of the color that were of the favorable to his reproduction. And then he goes on, verse 11, that the angel of God spoke to him in a dream. And verse 13, and I am the God of Bethel, where you were anointed the pillar, where you vowed a vow. Now arise, get you out of this land, and return to the land of your kindred. Now it's interesting, verse 14. And we look at this, Rachel and Leah answered. Because Jacob is explaining, this is why we need to go back. And Rachel and Leah answered and said, is there yet any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Fair question. In other words, we're going to leave everything behind. There's no inheritance. And they noted in verse 15, are we not counted of him, meaning Laban, as strangers? Meaning no inheritance. Strangers don't get an inheritance in the family. They went on, for he has sold us and devoured also our money. So by taking Jacob's hire, he has then traded his daughters for the wealth that Laban has gotten. Verse 16, for all the riches which God has taken from our father, it might be a better way to say produced through our father, meaning it says that is ours and our children's, and now that whatever God said that we do, do. Well, this is interesting. They said, wait a minute, what's going on here? The riches that God has produced here through originally through the father's flock, we've all worked for. It's now our family. We've worked for it. And so what is verse 17? Jacob rose up, set his sons and his wives on camels, and he carried away all his cattle, his goods which he had gotten, and his cattle of his getting, which he had gotten there, meaning in Paddan Aram, to go to Isaac his father in the land of Canaan. So in other words, they packed up. Didn't tell anybody. They packed up and they left town. Verse 19, and Laban went to shear his sheep. He wasn't home. And where do we read? Now we have this interesting King James words that Rachel had stolen the images that were her father's. In Matthew Henry's commentary, states three reasons why Rachel might have taken the images from her father Laban. First of all, Matthew Henry says that the word used, teraphim, they were merely images of family ancestors, which Rachel had a fondness for, like call them family heirlooms. And they were important remembrances. She was going to be leaving, going away, never to return. And so going to another country, to her husband's home. And so those little teraphim, those little statuettes, those were just heirlooms. That's one possibility that Matthew Henry pointed out. And the second possibility said, though they were images for religious use, to be worshipped or consulted as oracles, and we've seen little images like that in other religions and cultures, and that was not uncommon. But so that was one possibility, Matthew Henry suggests. Or his third suggestion, she designed to deprive her father Laban of the use of the images. Now, it could be she wanted to demonstrate that the folly of worshiping the images couldn't even save themselves. If they were gods, well, then save yourself. But nope, they were gone. So that's Matthew Henry put out that possibility. And that, or would be prevent her father, Laban, from consulting them to see what to do next. Pascal and Hobbes, the teacher's Bible commentary, has another explanation. And the word for images, the Hebrew teraphim, which also is translated as Hebrew gods, were regarded in Near Eastern cultures as tokens of property rights. I had an Iranian student some years ago, and his family went back to Iran, which is formerly known as Persia. And how they were able to get in and out of the country, I'm not sure, living in Rogers, Arkansas. And he brought back a special present. Probably should have brought it today. He said it was really hard to find. Little statue. And they had them of ancient kings. And these were very important for family ancestries and so forth. And he said these were hard to smuggle out of Iran because the Islamic Republic is trying to put away all of those images of royalty and ancestors so that you're all loyal to the Islamic Republic and not the Persian kings of old. But he brought these little statuette. So I'm reading about this from Pascal and Hobbes, that these were tokens of family rights. They didn't have notarized documents where they could run down, fill out a will, fill out a last testament, perhaps a trust and so forth, whatever you're going to do, like we do nowadays. Instead, because most people weren't literate, they had the statuettes. Who possessed the statuette or the little teraphim had the rights to inherit. That's according to Pascal and Hobbes. Now, you notice there's very different observations here from Matthew Henry and Pascal and Hobbes. Some say, well, they're pagan, little pagan gods, and so forth. And the other one says, no, they're evidence of potential inheritance. So I looked at Schultz's commentary called The Old Testament Speaks. And it's copyrighted both 1960 and 1970. And he writes in there, it's very interesting. Now, I have this particular book because it was a textbook for my Pentateuch class back in the old days, decades ago. And Schultz said that the images were evidence of a property, a family property right, is a more correct understanding. So he's saying that because they didn't have wills and testament, whoever possessed that little icon possessed the right to inherit. So you can see the complication now. We have Rachel is taking these little statuettes, and we're going to read that Laban was very angry about it. We already know that Laban's sons were jealous or upset, envious of the estate, and saying that Jacob and the sisters were taking everything. Well, this is a problem for the sons. They figured it would lessen their inheritance. They were going to get the inheritance because they were the sons. The daughters would inherit through their husbands. But so Rachel thought, well, what if we're bereft of anything, and Laban changes his mind, takes everything away? It appears that she was going to seize the family property rights. Now, this was umpty years ago. I had a grandmother-in-law who died. There were 7 kids in the family. And everybody was happy at the funeral, and they all took the family pictures, and the next day they all went out and hired a lawyer. It was really quite something to behold. Well, we know that Laban respected Jacob's God, and we know that Laban was blessed, knew that he was blessed because of Jacob's God. So we're going to take a look when, in a few verses, when Laban listened to Jacob's God, when God spoke to Laban the night before, when he chased Laban, or when he chased Jacob and Leah and Rachel. Well, the property rights or inheritance is an important consideration because, as mentioned, there was no earlier evidence of Laban having sons when he originally contracted for Jacob to marry Rachel. He wanted somebody to take over the estate. And Rachel was attending to those flock of sheep that would normally be done by the sons. And it's 20 years later now that we're looking at Jacob and Leah and Rachel leaving. So did Rachel steal the images? Let's look at the word stole as presented in Genesis 30. And in verse 19, Laban went to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole the images that were her father. Verse 20, and Jacob stole away unawares. and told him not that he fled. If we take a look at Strong's exhaustive concordance in Hebrew, the Hebrew word 1589, it can indeed mean to thieve or to steal, but it can also mean to carry away or to secretly bring or to get by stealth, and it's often used in the Bible figuratively. So the word here, when it was used, does not necessarily mean that somebody took something that wasn't theirs. It just means it was done secretly or quietly. If we read on here in verse 21, we're already in, we'll get the right chapter here. I think we're in 31. So he fled, Jacob fled with all he had, rose up and passed over the river and set his face toward Mount Gilead. And it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob was fled. Now Jacob was out shearing sheep. So it took a while for the message to get to him. Remember, they lived 3 days apart. And so what did Laban do? He took his brethren with him, meaning all of his employees and his sons, and pursued after him 7 days of journey, and they overtook him at Mount Gilead. Verse 24, and God came to Laban the Syrian in a dream by night, take heed that you speak not to Jacob either good or bad. This is interesting. And then, of course, we read on, Laban overtook Jacob. And Laban says, verse 27, why did you flee away secretly and steal away from me? And here we get this same word used, in other words, secretly go away. And you didn't tell me, I've sent you away with a party, okay, with songs and so forth. Well, and I could have said goodbye. And so, and what does Jacob answer, verse 31? Because I was afraid. For I said, what if he would take by force my daughters from me? Laban never gave up anything. Every time there was a deal made, Laban would never give it up. He would always change the terms of the deal. Verse 32, from with whomsoever you find, and here is the word gods in King James, the teraphim, the statuettes, let him not live. In other words, you're going to claim that we stole these things? No, and Jacob knew he was innocent of that. We would never have taken those things. He just left. He said, let that person not live before our brethren. Discern what is yours with me and take it. For Jacob knew not that Rachel had taken the items. So what did Laban do? He searched everywhere. Jacob's tent, Leah's tent, the maidservant's tent. He found out, he went out of Leah's tent, entered Rachel's tent. Now, Rachel, it says in verse 34, had taken the images, the statuettes, but she put them in the camel's furniture. So she had hidden them. And she sat on top of them. And Laban searched everywhere, searched and couldn't find them. And then she says to her father, don't be angry with me, but it's my time of month. I can't get off the camel. And he respected that, and he didn't find it. So now Jacob's really angry. Laban, his father-in-law, accused him basically of stealing the inheritance. And Jacob says, what is my trespass? Meaning, what's my sin that you've chased after me? You've searched my stuff. You haven't found anything. 20 years I worked for you. All the livestock I have, I've earned it all. Despite everything, whether it was stolen, whether it died on its own, I've always given you your share and suffered the loss myself over those 20 years. And you, verse 41, you've changed my wages 10 times. Ever work for a boss like that? You know the number one reason that salesmen leave their employer? The boss changes their compensation package. Number one reason. I know I've been in sales, and I've hired a lot of salesmen, so I'm well acquainted with that challenge, and I'm acquainted with the story as well. So you have an expectation. They want to meet that expectation. So Laban then in 43 says, hey, those are my daughters that you're taking away. Those are children. Their children are mine, meaning his grandchildren. What's the deal here? You're taking my stuff away again. And so Jacob was showing that he was right. That, what does Laban say? All you see is mine. Laban couldn't give it up. He had already made the bargain. He had already, as his daughter says, he sold us to no inheritance. So what does Laban propose in verse 44? Let us make a covenant, an agreement, between the two of us. And this covenant, there's got to be a witness between it. Jacob took a stone and set it up for a pillar. Remember back when Jacob, 20 years before, was coming up to Padanaram, and he set up a pillar of stones at Bethel regarding his inheritance for Abraham's blessings? Back in Genesis 28, 22, we read that. Well, now Jacob, again, in verse 46, said to his brethren, gather stones, and they took them, and they made a heap. And they did eat there upon the heap. They shared a meal. Here's this pile of stones. Why would they do that? Verse 48, Laban said, this heap, meaning of stones, is a witness between me and you this day. And therefore, the name of it is called Galeed. And it looks like it's spelled differently in different translations. And now, verse 49, he said, the Lord watch between me and you when we're absent from one another. If you afflict my daughters or take other wives, and no man is with us, God will be the witness between us. Does it sound like he's worshiping pagan gods? He's accepting, apparently, Jacob's God and says, God's going to watch you. He's looking out for what's going to happen in the future because I'm not going to be there. Here's this pile of stones. Here's the deal. Verse 52, this heap shall be a witness, this pillar. I won't pass over this heap of stones to you, and you will not pass over this heap and this pillar to me. Interesting, two more words, for harm. You can come and visit, but what would those statuettes have allowed Rachel to do? Claim the inheritance from Laban to harm his sons or his offspring for inheritance, for harm. So you can come over, you can come and visit, but you're disclaiming any potential inheritance by this covenant. You can't cross over the line. And what does verse 53? Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac and the God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, the God of their father, to judge between us. So you have this bargain between the two. So Jacob and Laban agreed not to cross the line marked by the pillar. It was a perpetual witness. Here's the cornerstone. Here's the mark. Don't cross over it. Jacob then relinquished his claim to inheritance of Laban's estate through his wives. Laban was now a wealthy man. And in return, Laban relinquished any claim that he had belonging to Jacob or Laban's daughters. To Jacob himself or to Laban's daughters. And Laban invoked the witness of God to keep the arrangement secure. So let's go back now to the original questions. Was Rachel a thief? Did she violate the commandments against stealing when she removed the images from her father? Well, the words said that she took them and went away quietly. She was securing what she thought was her inheritance. Her potential that was being stolen from her husband. She didn't have Social Security. She didn't have a widow's pension. All she had was her husband and her children to look after her, and she was securing, from all appearances, by getting the teraphim, the statuettes that guaranteed inheritance, because she knew she couldn't trust her father to give an inheritance. Was Rachel hanging on to pagan practices of worshiping the statues as gods? We have no evidence of that. There's no comment about that being worshiped at all. Why was Laban so upset at the missing images or gods? There's no evidence that he was worshiping those images, but he would be upset if somebody stole the will and made off with it and changed it for his sons and could come in and swoop in on the estate. So if we turn to Philippians 2 and verse 5, Philippians 2 and verse 5, we are given this awareness by Paul's letter to the church at Philippi. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God. Now, I'm going to put this together because there are people that say, well, if you go to that church and you think you're going to be born into the family of God and the kingdom of God, well, that's blasphemy and you're usurping what is only God's. And Paul tells us it's not robbery to claim your inheritance. If we take a look in Revelation 21, verse 7. In Revelation 21 and verse 7. He that overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. So there's potential inheritance for those who are overcomers. And it's not robbery, then, to join God's family. And if we're overcomers, we stand to inherit. Now let's turn to Romans 8. Romans 8, and let's turn to verse 14. In Romans 8, 14. For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, these are the sons of God. For you did not receive the spirit of bondage again to fear, but you received the spirit of adoption by whom we cry out, Abba, Father. The Spirit himself itself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. Verse 17, if children, then heirs, heirs of God, and joint heirs with Christ. If we indeed suffer with him, that we may be also glorified together. So we have a claim to an inheritance. This inheritance is that we are joint heirs with Christ, heirs of God. But it depends on us if we claim that inheritance. Now, Rachel was claiming her inheritance. Let's turn to Galatians 3. In Galatians 3, and in verse 27. For as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek, neither slave nor free, there's neither male nor female. You are all one in Christ Jesus. And if you are Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. So we stand to inherit, heirs according to the promise, if we're overcomers, to be joint heirs with Christ. That, and it's not robbery to be thought that we could join the God family. So when we look at the example, why is this even written in the Bible about Rachel and taking the tokens of inheritance? Let's take a look at Matthew 13:44. In Matthew 13:44, and flesh it out. In Matthew 13:44, again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a treasure hid in a field, which a man found, he hides for joy thereof, and sells all that he has and buys the field. He's making a claim, he's buying the field and everything that's in it. Or it's the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant man seeking godly pearls. When he has found it of great price, he went off, sold all that he had, and bought it. They had special knowledge. They were claiming that inheritance, that knowledge. The kingdom of God is like that. Rachel was making her claim for an inheritance. And then let's finally turn the last scripture, turn to Jude 1 and verse 3. In Jude 1, verse 3. Beloved, When I gave all diligence to write to you of the common salvation, it was needful for me to write to you and exhort you that you should earnestly contend for the faith that was once delivered to the saints. It doesn't say sit on your hands and wait and hope it all turns out. It says you must earnestly contend for the faith. And we can see that Rachel was earnestly contending for her inheritance. So should we earnestly contend for our inheritance, because we should follow the principle that let no man take our crown. It is up to us to seize the hope and the blessings of Abraham and the promises that we can join the kingdom of God.